whose name was Alder Acorn Agnes Allison Fragrant Timber, said she vaguely remembered some humans, unusually filthy and bedraggled specimens, now that you mention it, bringing Quentin in on a makeshift litter. He'd been unconscious and deep in shock, with his ribcage crushed and one of his forelimbs badly dislocated, practically detached. Such anatomical disorder was distasteful to the centaurs, and they were not insensible of the service the humans had rendered to Fillory in ridding it of Martin Chatwin. They did their best to render assistance. The humans lingered in the area for a month, maybe two, while the centaurs wove deep webs of wood magic around Quentin's torn, bruised, insulted body. But they thought it unlikely that he would ever wake up, and in time, as Quentin showed no signs of recovering consciousness, the humans reluctantly departed. He supposed he could have been angry that they had left him there, in Fillory, with no way of returning to his own world, but all he felt was warm, cowardly relief. He didn't have to face them. The sight of their faces would have burned the skin right off him with shame. He wished he had died, and if he couldn't have death, at least he had this, the next best thing, total isolation, lost forever in Fillory. He was broken in a way that magic could never fix. His body was still weak, and he spent a lot of time in bed resting his atrophied muscles. He was an empty shell, roughly hollowed out by some crude tool, gutted and left there, a limp, raw, boneless skin. If he tried, he could summon up old sense memories. Nothing from Fillory or Breakbills, just the really old stuff, the easy stuff, the safe stuff. The smell of his mother's oil paints, the lurid green of the Gowanus Canal, the curious way Julia pursed her lips around the reed of her oboe, the hurricane that blew through when they took that family vacation in Maine, he must have been about 8, when they went out on the lawn and threw their sweaters in the air and watched them sail away over the neighbor's fence and then fell down laughing. A beautiful blossoming white cherry tree stood outside his window in the warm afternoon sunlight. Every part of it moved and swayed in a slightly different rhythm from every other part. He watched it for a long time. If he was feeling daring, he thought about the time he'd spent as a goose flying south over Patagonia, wingtip to wingtip with Alice, buoyed up by pillowy masses of empty air, gazing coolly down at looping, squiggly, switchbacked rivers. If he did it now, he thought, he would remember to look out for the Nazca lines in Peru. He wondered if he could go back to Professor Vandeveer and have her change him back, and he would just stay that way, live and die as a stupid goose, and forget that he'd ever been a human. Sometimes he thought of a day he'd spent with Alice on the roof of the cottage. They had a joke that they were going to play on the others when they got back from somewhere, but the others never came home, and he and Alice had just lain up there on the warm shingles all afternoon, looking at the sky and talking about nothing. A few days of this went a long way. His body was healing fast and getting restless, and his brain was waking up and needed new diversions to distract it. It wouldn't leave him alone for long. Onward and upward, he couldn't stop himself from getting better. Soon Quentin was out and about and exploring the grounds, a walking skeleton. Severed from his past and from everything and everyone he knew, he felt as insubstantial and semi-existent as a ghost. The monastery, the centaur name for it was the Retreat, was all stone colonnades and towering trees and wide, well-maintained paths. Despite himself, he was ravenously hungry, and although the centaurs were strict vegetarians, they turned out to be wizards with salad. At mealtimes they set out huge, heaping wooden troughs full of spinach and lettuce and arugula and sharp dandelion greens, all delicately oiled and spiced. He discovered the centaur baths, 6 rectangular stone pools of varying temperatures, each one large enough that he could do 3 long, deep breaststrokes from one edge to the other. They reminded him of the Roman baths in Alice's parents' house. And they were deep, too. If he dove in and kicked downward with enough vigor until the light dimmed and his hindbrain complained and the water pressure forced its fingers into his ears, he could still just barely brush the rough stone bottom with his fingers. His mind was an icy pond constantly in danger of thawing. He trod on it only lightly. Its surface was perilously slick, and who knew how thin. To break through would mean immersion in what was below, cold, dark, anaerobic water and angry, toothy fish. The fish were memories. He wanted to put them away somewhere and forget where he'd put them, but he couldn't. The ice gave way at the oddest moments, when a fluffy, talking chipmunk looked up at him quizzically, when a centaur nurse was inadvertently kind to him, when he caught a glimpse of his face in a mirror. Something hideous and saurian would rise up, and his eyes would flood, and he would wrench himself away. The grief he felt for Alice kept unfolding new dimensions he hadn't known were there. He felt like he'd only seen and loved her, really loved her, all of her, for those last few hours. Now she was gone, broken like the glass animals she'd made that first day they'd met, and the rest of his life lay in front of him like a barren, meaningless postscript. For the first few weeks after his resurrection, Quentin felt deep aches in his chest and shoulder, but they faded as more weeks piled on top of those first few. He was at first shocked and subsequently kind of fascinated to discover that the centaurs had replaced the skin and muscle tissue he'd lost to the beast with something that looked very much like dark, fine-grained wood. 2/3 of his collarbone and most of his right shoulder and biceps now appeared to be composed of a smooth, highly polished fruit wood. Cherry, maybe, or possibly apple. The new tissue was completely numb. He could rap on it with his knuckles and not feel a thing. But it was perfectly able to flex and bend when and where he needed it to, and it merged gracefully with the flesh around it without a seam. He liked it. Quentin's right knee was wooden now, too. He couldn't actually remember having injured that particular part of him, but whatever, maybe something untoward had happened to it on the way back. And there was another change. His hair had gone completely white, even his eyebrows, like the man in Poe's Descent into the Maelstrom. He looked like he was wearing an Andy Warhol wig. He would do anything to keep from sitting still. He practiced with a bow and arrow on a wide, disused, weed-grown archery range. When he could get his attention, he had one of the younger centaurs teach him the rudiments of riding and fencing with a saber, in the name of physical therapy. Sometimes he pretended his sparring partner was Martin Chatwin. Sometimes he didn't. Either way, he never once landed a hit. A small contingent of talking animals had discovered Quentin's presence at the retreat, a badger and some oversized talking rabbits. Excited by the sight and smell of a human, and from Earth at that, they had gotten it into their heads that he was the next High King of Fillory, and when he angrily insisted that he wasn't, and that he'd lost all interest in that particular ambition, they dubbed him the Reluctant King, and left tributes of nuts and cabbages outside his windows, and constructed pathetic handmade, or paw-made, crowns for him woven out of twigs and adorned with worthless quartz pebbles. He tore them apart. A small herd of tame horses roamed the wide lawns of the retreat at will. At first, Quentin thought they were just pets, but the arrangement turned out to be slightly more complex than that. Centaurs of both sexes frequently copulated with the horses, publicly and loudly. Quentin had found his few meager possessions stacked in little piles along one wall of his room. He stowed them in a dresser. They took up exactly half of one of its 5 drawers. His room also held a battered old Florida-style writing desk, painted white and pale green, and one day Quentin went rummaging through its warped, poorly fitted drawers to see what previous inmates might have left behind. It had occurred to him to attempt some written magic, a basic scrying technique, to try to learn something about what had happened to the others. It almost certainly wouldn't work between planes, but you never knew. Along with an assortment of odd buttons and dried-out chestnuts and exotic Fillorian insect corpses, he found two envelopes. Also in the desk was a dry, tough, leafy branch. The envelopes were thick and made of the coarse, bleached-white paper the centaurs made. On the first, his name was written in an elegant calligraphic handwriting that Quentin recognized as Elliot's. His vision swam. He had to sit down. Inside it was a note. It was rolled around the flattened, dehydrated remains of what was once a single Merit ultralight cigarette, and it read as follows. Dear Q, hell of a thing getting you out of that dungeon. Richard showed up, finally, for which I suppose we should be grateful, though God knows he doesn't make it easy. We wanted to stay, Q, but it was hard, and getting harder every day. The centaurs said it wasn't working. But if you're reading this, then you woke up after all. I'm sorry about everything. I know you are, too. I know I said I didn't need a family to become who I was supposed to be, but it turned out that I did, and it was you. We'll meet again. E. The other envelope contained a notebook. It was thick and old-looking and squashed around the corners. Quentin recognized it instantly, even though he hadn't seen it since a chilly November afternoon 6 years ago. With a cold, clear mind, he sat down on his bed and opened The Magicians. The book was disappointingly short, maybe 50 handwritten pages, some of them smudged and water-damaged, and it was not written in Christopher Plover's usual plain, simple, open-hearted prose. It was cruder, funnier, more arch, and it showed signs of having been scribbled in haste, with a generous assortment of misspellings and missing words. This was because it wasn't written by Christopher Plover at all. It was, the author explained in the first paragraph, the first book of Fillory and Further by somebody who had actually been there. That person was Jane Chatwin. The story of The Magicians picked up immediately after the end of The Wandering Dune, after Jane, the youngest, and her sister Helen, that dear, self-righteous busybody, quarreled over Helen's hiding of the magic buttons that could take them to Fillory. Having failed to unearth them herself, Jane was forced to wait, but no further invitations to Fillory arrived. She and her siblings seemed fated to live out the rest of their lives on Earth as ordinary children. She supposed it was all right. After all, most children never got to go to Fillory at all. But it hardly seemed fair. The others had all gone to Fillory at least twice, and she'd only gotten to go once. And there was the matter of Martin. He was still missing after all this time. Their parents had long since given up hope, but the children hadn't. At night, Jane and the other little Chatwins crept into each other's bedrooms and whispered about him, wondering what adventures he was getting up to in Fillory, and when he would finally come home to them, as they knew he one day would. Years passed. Jane was 13, no longer a girl, as old as Martin was when he'd disappeared, when the call finally came. She was visited by a cooperative and industrious hedgehog named Prickleplump, who helped her recover an old cigar box containing the buttons from the old dry well down which Helen had dropped it. She could have enlisted one of the others to come with her, but instead Jane returned to Fillory alone, by way of the city, the only Chatwin ever to enter the other world without a sibling to keep her company. She found Fillory beset by a powerful wind. It blew and blew and never stopped blowing. At first it was amusing, and everybody flew kites, and a craze for flowy clothing that billowed out on the breeze swept through the royal court at Whitespire. But over time the wind became relentless. The birds were exhausted from struggling with it, and everybody's hair was getting tangled. The leaves were being stripped from the forest, and the trees were complaining. Even when you went inside and closed the door, you could still hear it groaning and feel it blowing on your face for hours afterward. Castle Whitespire's wind-powered clockwork heart threatened to spin out of control and had to be decoupled from its windmills and halted for the first time in living memory. A group of eagles and griffins and pegasi allowed themselves to be borne away on the wind, convinced that it would blow them away to a fantastical land, one even more magical than Fillory. They returned a week later, coming from the other direction, hungry and disheveled and windburned. They refused to discuss what they had seen. Jane belted on a rapier, put her hair up in a tight bun, and set off into the darkling woods alone, resolute, bent forward against the gale, heading upwind in search of its source. Soon she came across Ember, alone in a clearing. He was injured and distraught. He told her of Martin's transformation and his efforts to expel the child, which had ended with the death of Umber. They held a council of war. With a bellowing bleat, Ember summoned the cozy horse, and together they mounted its broad velvet back and set off to see the dwarves. Swing players at the best of times, the dwarves could never be relied upon to cooperate with anybody, but even they were convinced that Martin was dangerous, and besides, all that wind was blowing the topsoil off their beloved underground warrens. They fashioned for Jane a silver pocket watch, a work of consummate horological mastery, so dense with tiny gears and cams and glorious spiral springs that its interior was a solid, teeming mass of gleaming clockwork. With it, the dwarves explained, Jane could control the flow of time itself, turn it forward, turn it back, speed it up, slow it down, as she liked. Jane and Ember left with the pocket watch, shaking their heads. Honestly, there was never any telling what the dwarves were capable of. If they could build a time machine, you wondered why they didn't run the whole kingdom. Except, she supposed, that they couldn't be bothered. Quentin turned the last page. The book ended there. It was signed on the bottom of the last page by Jane herself. Well, that was anticlimactic, Quentin said out loud.
The truth doesn't always make a good story, does it? But I think I tied up most of the loose threads. I'm sure you can fill in the rest if you really think about it.
Quentin practically jumped out of what was left of his skin. Sitting on top of his desk on the other side of the room, very still, long legs crossed, was a small, pretty woman with dark hair and pale skin. At least I tried to make a good entrance. She had gone native. She wore a light brown cloak over a practical gray traveling dress that was slit up the sides far enough to show some leg. But it was unmistakably her. The paramedic, and the woman who'd visited him in the infirmary. And yet that wasn't who she was at all. "You're Jane Chatwin, aren't you?" She smiled brightly and nodded.
"I autographed it," she pointed to the manuscript. "Imagine what it would be worth. Sometimes I think about turning up at a Fillory convention just to see what would happen."
"They'd probably think you were a cosplayer," Quentin said, "and getting a little old for it." He set aside the manuscript on the bed. He had been very young when he met her for the first time, but he wasn't young anymore. As her brother Martin would have said, "My, how he'd grown." Her smile was not as irresistible as it used to be.
"You were the Watcher woman, too, weren't you?"
"Was and am." Still sitting, she sketched a curtsy. "I suppose I could retire now that Martin is gone, though really I've only just started to enjoy myself." He expected himself to smile back at her, but the smile did not materialize. He didn't feel like smiling. Quentin
couldn't have said exactly what he was feeling. Jane remained very still, studying him, as she had that first day they met. Her presence was so laden with magic and meaning and history that she almost glowed. To think she had spoken to Plover himself and told him the stories Quentin had grown up on. The circularity of it all was dizzying. The sun was setting, and the light stained Quentin's white bedspread a dusky orange pink. The edges of everything were softening in the twilight. "This doesn't make any sense," he said. He had never felt less tempted by a pretty woman's charms. "If you were the Watcher Woman, why did you do all those things? Stop time and all that?" She smiled wryly. "This item," she produced a silver pocket watch as thick and round as a pomegranate from somewhere in her cloak, "did not come with an instruction manual. It took a bit of experimenting before I got the hang of it, and some of those experiments weren't so successful. There was one long afternoon in particular." She grimaced. Her accent was the twin of Martin's. "People took it the wrong way. And anyhow, Plover embroidered all that stuff. What an imagination that man had." She shook her head as if Plover's flights of fancy were the most incredible part of all this. "And you know, I was only 13 when I started out. I had no training in magic at all, and I had to figure everything out on my own. I suppose I'm a bit of a hedge witch that way." "So all those things the Watcher Woman did, a lot of it did actually happen, but I was careful. The Watcher Woman never killed anyone. I cut corners, sometimes at other people's expense, but I had other things on my mind. My job was to stop Martin, and I did what I had to. Even those clock trees," she snorted ruefully. "Brilliant idea, those were. They never did a bloody thing. The funniest part is that Martin was terrified of them. He couldn't figure them out." For a moment her face lost its composure, just for a moment. Her eyes welled with tears, and she blinked rapidly. "I keep telling myself that we lost him that first night, when he walked away into the forest. It was never him after that. Not really. He died a long time ago. But I'm the only Chatwin left now. He was a monster, but he was the last family I had." "And we killed him," Quentin said coldly. His heart was palpitating. The feeling he'd had trouble identifying earlier was clarifying itself. It was rage. This woman had used him, used them all, like toys. And if some of the toys got broken, oh well. That had been the real point of the whole story all along. She had manipulated him, sent him and the others into Fillory to find Martin. She had made sure he got there. For all he knew, she'd planted the button for Lovelady to find in the first place. It didn't matter now. It was over, and Alice was dead. He stood up. A cool, grassy evening breeze stirred the green curtains. "Yes," Jane Chatwin said carefully. "You killed him. We won." "We won?" He was incredulous. He couldn't hold back any more. All the grief and guilt he'd been salting away so carefully was coming back to him as anger. The ice was cracking. The pond was boiling. "We won? You have a damn time machine in your pocket, and that's the best you could do? You set us up, Jane, or whoever the fuck you are. We thought we were going on an adventure, and you sent us on a suicide mission, and now my friends are dead. Alice is dead." Here he had to swallow hard before he could go on. "Is that really the best you could do?" She dropped her eyes to the floor. "I am sorry." "You're sorry?" The woman was unbelievable. "Good. Show me how sorry you are. Take me back. Use the watch. We'll go back in time. We'll do it all again. Let's go back and fix this." "No, Quentin," she said gravely. "We can't go back."
"What do you mean, no? We can go back. We can, and we will."
He was talking at her louder and louder, staring at her, as if by talking and staring he could force her into doing what he needed her to do. She had to. And if talking wouldn't do it, he could make her. She was a small woman, and apart from that watch, he was willing to bet that he was twice the magician she'd ever be. She was shaking her head sadly. "You have to understand." She didn't back away. She spoke softly, as if she could soothe him, placate him into forgetting what she'd done. "I'm a witch. I'm not a god. I've tried this so many ways. I've gone down so many different timelines. I've sent so many other people to fight, Martin. Don't make me lecture you on the practicalities of chronological manipulation, Quentin. Change one variable and you change them all. Did you think you were the first one to face Martin in that room? Do you think that was even the first time you faced him? That battle has been fought again and again. I've tried it so many different ways. Everyone always died, and I always wound back the clock. As bad as it was, as bad as it is, this is by far the best outcome I've ever achieved. No one ever stopped him but you and your friends, Quentin. You were the only ones. And I'm sticking with it. I can't risk losing everything we've gained."
Quentin folded his arms. Muscles were jumping in his back. He was practically vibrating with fury.
"Well then, we'll go back all the way. To before the world in the walls. Stop him before it all starts. Find a timeline where he doesn't even go to Fillory."
"I've tried, Quentin. I've tried."
She was pleading with him.
"He always does. I've tried it 1,000 times. There is no world where he doesn't. I'm tired. I know you lost, Alice. I lost my brother. I'm tired of fighting that thing that used to be Martin."
Suddenly she did look very tired, and her eyes lost their focus, as if she was seeing into some other world, one she would never get to. It made it hard for him to keep up his high-pressure rage. It kept bleeding away, even as he stoked it. This wasn't over. He lunged, but she saw it coming. He was quick, but she was quicker. Maybe they'd played this scene already, in another timeline, or maybe he was just that obvious. Before he was halfway across the room, she spun on her heel and threw the silver watch as hard as she could at the wall. It was hard enough. The wall was stone, and the watch squashed like an overripe fruit. It made a sound like a bag of nickels. The delicate crystal face shattered, and tiny gears and wheels skittered away across the floor like pearls from a broken necklace. Jane turned back to him defiantly, breathing hard. He stared down at the corpse of the broken timepiece.
"No more," she said. "Put an end to it. It's time to live with what we have and mourn what we lost. I wish I could have told you more before it was too late, but I needed you too much to tell you the truth."
In a curious gesture, she placed her hands on his cheeks, drew his face down to hers, and kissed him on the forehead. The room was almost dark now. The door creaked in the quiet spring evening as she opened it.
"Try not to judge Martin too harshly," she said from the doorway. "Plover used to diddle him whenever he could get him alone. I think that's why he went to Fillory in the first place. Why else would he try to crawl into a grandfather clock? He was looking for somewhere to hide."
With that, she was gone. Quentin didn't go after her, just stared at the doorway for a long minute. When he walked over to the door to close it, pieces of the broken watch scrunched under his feet. It just went down and down. Had he finally gotten to the bottom of it? In the last of the dying light, he looked down at the notebook on the hard centaur bed. There was a note tucked into the pages, the same one the wind had snatched away from him the first time he tried to read it. But all it said was,
Surprise!
He sat back down. In the end, he and Alice had just been bit players, extras, who had the bad luck to wander into a battle scene. A brother and sister at war with each other in their nightmare nursery fantasy land. No one cared that Alice was dead, and no one cared that he wasn't. Now he had answers, but they weren't doing what answers were supposed to do. They weren't making things simpler or easier. They weren't helping. Sitting there on his bed, he thought about Alice, and poor stupid Penny, and miserable Elliot, and that poor bastard Martin Chatwin. He got it now, of course, finally. He'd been going about this all wrong. He should never have come here at all. He should never have fallen in love with Alice. He should never even have come to Brakebills. He should have stayed in Brooklyn in the real world. He should have nursed his depression and his grudge against the world from the relative safety of mundane reality. He never would have met Alice, but at least she would be alive, somewhere. He could have eked out his sad, wasted life with movies and books and masturbation and alcohol, like everybody else. He would never have known the horror of really getting what he thought he wanted. He could have spared himself and everybody else the cost of it. If there was a moral to the story of Martin Chatwin, that was it in a nutshell. Sure, you can live out your dreams, but it'll only turn you into a monster. Better to stay home and do card tricks in your bedroom instead. It was partly Jane's fault, of course. She had lured him on at every turn. Well, he wouldn't get fooled again. He wouldn't give anybody the chance. Quentin felt a new attitude of detachment descend on him. His molten anger and grief were cooling into a glossy, protective coating, a hard, transparent lacquer of uncaring. If he couldn't go back, he would just have to do things differently going forward. He felt how infinitely safer and more sound this attitude was. The trick was just not wanting anything. That was power. That was courage. The courage not to love anyone or hope for anything. The funny thing about it was how easy everything got when nothing mattered. Over the next few weeks, the new Quentin, with his white Warhol hair and his wooden Pinocchio shoulder, took up his magical studies again. What he wanted now was control. He wanted to be untouchable. In his little cell, Quentin practiced things he'd never had time to master before, or never dared to try. He went back to the most advanced popper exercises, gruesomely difficult, only theoretically executable etudes that he'd faked his way through back at Brakebills. Now he repeated them over and over again, smoothing out the rough edges. He invented new, even crueler versions and mastered them as well. He relished the pain in his hands, ate it up. His enchantments took on a power and precision and fluency they'd never had before. His fingertips left tracks of fire and sparks and neon indigo smears in the air that buzzed and whined, too bright to look at directly. His brain glowed with cold, brittle triumph. This was what Penny had been looking for when he went to Maine, but Quentin was actually doing it. Only now, he thought, now that he had killed off his human emotions, only now that he didn't care anymore, could he wield truly superhuman power. As the sweet spring air drifted through his room, and then the oven-hot summer air, and sweat poured down his face, and the centaurs trotted by outside his door, lofty and incurious, he came to see how Mayakovsky had performed some of the feats Quentin had found so baffling. In an empty meadow, he carefully reverse-engineered Penny's flashy fireball spell. He found and corrected the mistakes he'd made in his senior project, the trip to the moon, and he finished Alice's project, too, in memoriam, isolating and capturing a single photon, and even observing it. Heisenberg be damned. an infinitely furious, precious, incandescent little wave spark. Seated in the lotus position on top of the sun-faded Florida desk, he allowed his mind to expand until it encompassed one, then three more, then six field mice in all as they went about their tiny, urgent business in the grass outside his window. He summoned them to sit before him and, with a thought, gently extinguished the electrical current that lived within each of them. Their little fluffy bodies went still and cold. Then, just as easily, he touched each of them with magic, instantly relighting their tiny souls as if he were touching a match to the pilot light of a stove. Panicked, they scrambled in all directions. He let them go. Alone in his room, he smiled at his secret greatness. He felt lordly and munificent. He had tampered with the sacred mystery of life and death. What else was there in this world that could engage his attention, or in any world? June ripened into July, then burst and withered and dried and became August. One morning Quentin woke up early to find a cool mist hanging low over the lawn outside his first-floor window. Standing there in plain view, looking huge and ethereal, was a white stag. It bent to crop the grass with its small mouth, tilting its grand, top-heavy rack of antlers, and he could see the muscles working in its neck. Its ears were bigger and floppier than he would have expected. It raised its head again when Quentin appeared in the window, conscious of being observed, then sauntered off across the lawn and disappeared unhurriedly from view. Frowning, Quentin watched it go. He went back to bed, but couldn't sleep. Later in the day, he sought out Alder Acorn Agnes Allison Fragrant Timber. He found her working an elaborate, room-size loom built to harness both the pumping power of her muscular back legs and the delicate manipulations of her human fingers. "The questing beast," she said, breathing hard, still pumping, her hands still weaving. "It is a rare sight. Undoubtedly it was drawn here by the positive energies radiated by our superior values. You are fortunate that it offered itself to some centaur's sight while you happened to be watching." The questing beast, from the girl who told time. So that was what it looked like. Somehow he'd expected something more ferocious. Quentin patted Agnes on her glossy black hindquarters and left. He knew what he had to do. That night he took out the leafy branch he had found in the writing desk. It was the branch that had hung in front of the beast's face, which it had tossed aside right before their battle. The branch was dead and dried now, but its leaves were still olive and rubbery. He stuck its hard stem in the moist turf and mounded up some dirt to make sure it stayed upright. The next morning, Quentin woke to find a fully grown tree outside his window. Set into its trunk was the face of a softly ticking clock. He put his hand on the tree's hard, gray trunk, feeling its cool, dusty bark, then let it drop. His time here was over. He packed a few possessions, abandoned others, stole a bow and quiver of arrows from the shed by the archery range, liberated a horse from the centaur's feral sex herd, and left the retreat. A White Stag. The hunt for the questing beast took him to the edge of the vast northern marsh, then back south, skirting the edge of the great bramble, then north again, angling west through the darkling woods as far as the vast, gently gurgling expanse of the lower slosh. It was like visiting places he'd seen in dreams. He drank from streams and slept on the ground and ate fire-roasted game. He had become a passable archer, and when he couldn't hit something on his own, he used magic to cheat. He rode his horse hard. She was a gentle bay who didn't seem very sorry to leave the centaurs behind. Quentin's mind was as empty of thoughts as the woods and fields were of people. The pond in his head was frozen again, a foot thick this time. On his best days he could go hours without thinking about Alice. If he thought of anything, it was the white stag. He was on a quest, but it was his quest now, nobody else's. He scanned the skyline for the prickle of its antlers and thickets for the flash of its pale flank. He knew what he was doing. This was what he'd dreamed about all the way back in Brooklyn. This was the primal fantasy. When he had finished it, he could close the book for good. The questing beast led him even farther west, through the hills of the Chankly Boar, over a pass in a bitterly sharp mountain range, beyond anything he recognized or had ever heard of from the Fillory books. He was in virgin territory now, but he didn't stop to explore or name the peaks. He descended a blazing white chalk cliff to a strip of volcanic black sand on the shore of a great undiscovered western sea. When it spotted him still in pursuit, the stag bounded out onto the surf as if it were dry land. It leaped from breaker to breaker and swell to swell, like it was jumping from crag to crag, antlers erect, shaking its head and snuffing sea foam from its nostrils. Quentin sighed. The next day he sold the gentle bay and booked passage across the western sea. He managed to hire a nimble sloop named, embarrassingly enough, the Skywalker, crewed by an efficient foursome of three taciturn brothers and their burly, suntanned sister. Without speaking, they swarmed through Skywalker's fiendishly idiosyncratic rigging, which consisted of 24 small lateen sails that required constant minor adjustments. They were awed by his wooden prosthetics. 2 weeks out, they put in at a jolly tropical archipelago, a sun-drenched scatter pattern of mango swamps and sheep meadows, to take on fresh water. Then they pushed on. They passed an island inhabited by angry, bloodthirsty giraffes and a floating beast that offered them an extra year of life in exchange for a finger. The sister took the beast up on it, times three. They passed an ornate wooden staircase that spiraled down into the ocean, and a young woman adrift on an open book the size of a small island in which she scribbled tirelessly. None of these adventures inspired in Quentin anything resembling wonder or curiosity. All that was over for him. 5 weeks out, they made landfall on a scorched black rock, and the crew threatened to mutiny if they didn't turn back. Quentin stared them down, then bluffed about his magical powers. Then finally, quintupled their pay. They sailed on. Being brave was easy when you would rather die than give up. Fatigue meant nothing when you actually wanted to suffer. Before this, Quentin had never been on a sailboat big enough to have a jib, but now he was as lean and brown and salty-skinned as his crew. The sun became huge, and the seawater grew hot against the Skywalker's gunwales. Everything felt electrically charged. Ordinary objects gave off strange optical effects, flares and sunspots and coronas. The stars were low, burning orbs, visibly spherical, pregnant with illegible meaning. A powerful golden light shone through everything, as if the world were only a thin scrim behind which a magnificent sun was shining. The stag kept bounding on ahead of them. At last, an unknown continent filled the horizon. It was wrapped in a magical winter and thickly wooded with fir trees that grew right up to the shore so that the salt water lapped at their tangled roots. Quentin dropped anchor and told the crew, who were shivering in their thin tropical clothes, to wait a week and then leave without him if he wasn't back. He gave them the rest of the gold he'd brought, kissed the seven-fingered sister goodbye, lowered the sloop's caique, and rowed himself to shore. Strapping his bow to his back, he pushed his way into the snow-choked forest. It was good to be alone again. The questing beast showed itself on the third night. Quentin had made camp on a low bluff overlooking a clear spring-fed pool. Just before dawn, he woke to find it standing at the water's edge. Its reflection shivered as it lapped the cold water. He waited for a minute on one knee. This was it. He strung his bow and slipped an arrow from his quiver. Looking down from the low bluff with the early morning air almost dead, it wasn't even a difficult shot. At the moment of release, he thought, "I'm doing what even the Chatwins failed to do, Helen and Rupert." He didn't feel the pleasure he thought he would. He put his shaft through the tough meat of the white stag's muscular right thigh. He winced. Thank God he hadn't hit an artery. It didn't try to flee, just sat stiffly on its haunches like an injured cat. He had the impression from its resigned expression that the questing beast had to go through this kind of thing once a century or so, the cost of doing business. Its blood looked black in the pre-dawn twilight. It showed no fear as Quentin approached. It reached back with its supple neck and grasped the arrow firmly in its square white teeth. With a jerk, the shaft came free. It spat out the arrow at Quentin's feet.
"Hurts, that," the questing beast said matter-of-factly.
It had been 3 days since Quentin had spoken to anybody. "What now?" he said hoarsely.
"Wishes, of course. You get 3. My friend Penny lost his hands. Fix them."
The stag's eyes defocused momentarily in thought.
"I cannot. I am sorry. He is either dead or not in this world."
The sun was just beginning to come up over the dark, massed fir forest. Quentin took a deep breath. The cold air smelled fresh and turpentiny.
"Alice." She turned into some kind of spirit. "A niffin. Bring her back."
"Again, I cannot."
"What do you mean you can't? It's a wish."
"I don't make the rules," the questing beast said. It lapped at the blood that still trickled down its thigh.
"You don't like it? Find some other magic stag and shoot it instead."
"I wish that the rules were different." The stag rolled its eyes.
"No, and I'm counting those 3 together as your first wish. What's number 2?
Quentin sighed. He hadn't really allowed himself to hope.
"Pay off my crew. Double what I promised them."
"Done," the questing beast replied.
"That's 10 times their base salary since I already quintupled it."
"I said done, didn't I? What's number 3? Years ago, Quentin had worked out exactly what he would wish for if anybody ever gave him the chance. He would wish to travel to Fillory and to be allowed to stay there forever. But that was years ago.
"Send me home," he said.
The questing beast closed its round brown eyes gravely, then opened them. It dipped its antlers toward him.
"Done," it said.
Quentin supposed he could have been more specific. By rights, the questing beast could have sent him back to Brooklyn, or to his parents' house in Chesterton, or to Brakebills, or even to the house upstate. But the stag went the literal way with it, and Quentin wound up in front of his last semi-permanent residence, the apartment building in Tribeca that he'd shared with Alice. Nobody noticed as he abruptly came into being in the middle of the sidewalk in the late morning of what appeared to be an early summer day. He walked away quickly. He couldn't even look at their old doorway. He left his bow and arrows in a trash can. It was a shock to suddenly be surrounded by so many of his fellow human beings again at such close quarters, their mottled skins and flawed physiognomies and preening vanities were less easy to ignore. Maybe some of that centaur snobbery had rubbed off on him, A revolting stew of fragrances, both organic and inorganic, invaded his nose. The front page of a newspaper, acquired at the corner deli, informed him that he'd been gone from Earth for a little over 2 years. He would have to call his parents. Fog would have kept them from fretting too much, but still. It almost made him smile to think of seeing them now. What the hell would they say about his hair? Soon, but not yet. He walked around, getting reacclimated. The spells involved in retrieving cash from an ATM were child's play now. He got a shave and a haircut and bought some clothes that weren't made by centaurs and hence didn't look like a Renaissance fair costume. He babied himself. He had lunch at a fancy steakhouse and nearly died with pleasure. By 3 o'clock he was drinking Moscow mules in a long, dark, empty basement bar in Chinatown where he used to go with the physical kids. It had been a long time since he'd drunk alcohol. It had a dangerous thawing effect on his frozen brain. The ice that kept his feelings of guilt and sorrow under control creaked and groaned. But he kept on with it, and soon a deep, pure, luxurious sadness came over him, as heady and decadent as a drug. The place started filling up at 5. By 6, the after-work drinkers were jostling Quentin at the bar. He could see that the light falling down the stairs out front had changed. He was on his way out when he noticed a slender, pretty girl with blonde curls nuzzling the man who looked like an underwear model in a corner booth. Quentin didn't know the underwear model from Adam, but the pretty girl was definitely Anaïs. It wasn't the reunion he would have wanted, nor was she the person he would have chosen to reunite with. But maybe it was better this way, with somebody he didn't care too much about, who didn't care too much about him either. And he had those trusty Moscow mules to carry some of the load for him. Baby steps. They sat outside on the stairway. She put her hand on his arm and goggled at his white hair.
"You would not have believed it," she said.
Oddly, her pan-European accent had deepened and her English grammar worsened since he'd seen her last. Possibly it played better in the bar scene.
"The time we had getting out, it was quiet for a while, and then they rush us again. Josh was very good, you know, very good. I had never seen him work magic like that. There was a thing that swam in the floor, under the stones, like a shark, I think, but it swam in the stones. It got hold of your leg."
"That might explain this," Quentin said. He showed her his wooden knee, and she goggled all over again. The alcohol was making all this much easier than expected. He was braced for a torrent of emotion, a cavalry charge of grief on his defenseless peace of mind, but if it was coming, it hadn't yet.
"And there was a thing, a spell in the walls, I think, so that we went around in circles. We ended up in Amber's room again."
"Embers.
What did I say?"
"Anyhow,
we had to break the spell."
She stopped to wave through the window at her buff boyfriend in the bar. She sounded as if she'd told this story many times already, to the point where she was quite bored of it. For her, it all happened 2 years ago, to people she'd barely known anyway.
"And we carried you the whole way. My God, I don't think we would have made it if Richard hadn't found us. It almost makes you like him, you know? He had a way of making us invisible to the monsters. He practically carried us out of that place. Still, I have a scar."
She flounced up the hem of her skirt, which was none too long to begin with. A thick, bumpy keloid strip 6 inches long stood out from her smooth, tanned thigh. Amazingly, Penny had survived, she told him, or at least he had for a while. The centaurs were unable to reconstruct his hands, and without them he could no longer cast spells. When they reached the Netherlands, Penny walked away from the rest of the party as if he were searching for something. When he came to a tall, narrow, stone palazzo, Unusually old and worn, he stopped in front of it and spread out his handless arms as if in supplication. After a minute, the doors of the palazzo opened. The others caught a glimpse of ranks of bookcases, the warm, secret, paper heart of the city. Penny stepped inside, and the doors closed behind him.
"Can you believe it even all happened?" she kept saying. "It is like a cauchemar, but it is all over now."
It was strange. Anaïs didn't seem to blame him or herself. She had found some way of mourning what had happened. Or maybe it hadn't touched her to begin with. It was hard to guess what went on under those blonde curls. Throughout the story, she kept looking over his shoulder at the underwear model, and after a while he took pity on her and let her go. They said goodbye, kiss-kiss. Neither party promised to keep in touch. What was the point of lying now, at this late stage in the game? Like she said, it was all over now. He stayed sitting outside on the steps in the warm early hours of the summer evening, until it crossed his mind how much he didn't want to run into Anaïs again on her way out. It was getting dark, and he would need somewhere to sleep tonight. He could find a hotel, but why bother? And why wait? He had abandoned almost everything he owned back in Fillory, but one thing Quentin had hung on to was the iron key Fogg had given him when he graduated. It hadn't worked from Fillory. He'd tried. But now, standing by himself on a trash-littered street in Tribeca, breathing the soupy, sun-warmed city air, he took it out of the pocket of his brand-new jeans. It felt reassuringly hefty. On a hunch, he held it up to his ear. It gave off a high, constant, musical, ringing note, like a struck tuning fork. He'd never noticed that before. Feeling grandly lonely and only a little frightened, he gripped the key with both hands, closed his eyes, relaxed, and let it tug him forward. It was like riding the rope toe at a ski slope. The key parted an invisible seam in the air and drew him swiftly forward and with a delightful sense of acceleration through some highly convenient subdimension back to the stone terrace out behind the house at Brakebills. The pain of going back was great, but the necessity was greater. He had one last piece of business to take care of, and then it really would all be over forever. Kings and Queens. As the junior member of the Plaxco account team, associate management consultant Quentin Coldwater had few actual responsibilities beyond attending the occasional meeting and being civil to whatever colleagues he happened to bump into in the elevator. On the rare occasions when actual documents managed to make their way into his inbox or onto his desk, he rubber-stamped them. "Looks good to me, QC," without reading them, and sent them on their way. Quentin's desk was, as it happened, unusually large for a new hire at his level, especially one as youthful as he appeared to be, though his startling white hair lent him a certain gravitas beyond his years, and whose educational background and previous work history were on the sketchy side. He just appeared one day, took possession of a corner office recently vacated by a vice president 3 times his age, and started drawing a salary and piling up money in his 401k and receiving medical and dental benefits and taking 6 weeks of vacation a year, in return for which he didn't seem to do much of anything beyond play computer games on the ultra-flat, double-wide screen monitor the outgoing Veep had left behind. But Quentin didn't inspire any resentment in his new colleagues, or even any particular curiosity. Everybody thought somebody else knew the story on him, and if it turned out that they didn't, they definitely knew for a fact that somebody over in HR had the scoop. And anyway, supposedly he'd been a superstar at some high-flying European school, fluent in all kinds of languages, math scores through the roof. The firm was lucky to have him. Lucky. and he was affable enough, if a little mopey. He seemed smart, or at least he looked smart. And anyway, he was a member of the Plaxco account team, and here at the consulting firm of Grunnings Hunsucker Swan, everybody was a team player. Dean Fogg had advised Quentin against it. He should take more time, think it over, maybe get some therapy. But Quentin had taken enough time. He had seen enough of the magical world to last him the rest of his life,